There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome to the 47th episode of the 45th Podcast. I'm Susan Simpson, and I'm here today with Suraj, talking to you about Kushner's no good, very bad, terrible week.
I'm so sad I missed the 45th episode of the 45th Podcast.
Well, Mueller missed it too. It was exciting as usual. There was no fireworks going off.
So you mentioned Kushner. What's going on with Jared Kushner? I mean, I've seen the news, but you've probably been following this a little bit closely than I have.
Yeah, what's not going on with Kushner? It's been a very bad week for him. Apparently, I mean, we'll get into the bit, but both him and Ivanka and their friends, Rob Porter and Hope Hicks, have been on the outs a little bit, you might say.
So, yeah, I mean, I saw this about Kushner, about him not getting his, he got his security clearance downgraded from, what, not having a security clearance to definitely not having a security clearance?
Well, apparently Trump was good to his word. He did let Kelly make a final call on this, and there is no longer security clearance for Kushner. He never should have had the interim one, but he now is without one at all. Of course, Trump is the president and he can overrule whatever, you know, security measures are in place and order Kushner to be able to see, for instance, the president's daily briefing.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, on paper, it sounds good. In practice, it may or may not mean that Kushner has been, you know, cut off from access. And given that Kushner was one of the most frequent requesters of high priority sensitive information, it could have some effects on him. We'll see. But first, though, I wanted to hear more about your trip, I guess, a couple weeks back now to CPAC.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I did go to CPAC.
How was that?
It felt like an eternity ago. It was all right. So this was my fourth consecutive time going to CPAC. And, you know, a lot of people will say it was a love fest, which it was. But it was kind of tame in a sense that, you know, during the times in which conservatives and Republicans were not holding all three branches of government, you know, the White House, the House and Senate, they were a lot more fired up. Complacency and apathy seem to have set in at CPAC, and people just don't really care as much anymore because they're too tired of winning. So,
but Trump told them not to get complacent.
I know he told them not to get complacent, but, you know, that he should have sent that memo to them before everyone started showing up to CPAC, or a lack thereof, because from what I saw, they basically said that they were having record numbers of people there, but it did not pass the eye test. There were not as many people there as there were in years past, and there certainly weren't as many sponsors, which is troubling. And it's starting, it used to be like a media frenzy under Obama. It was all, you know, who would be running next against Obama in 2012, and then who would knock off whatever Democratic candidate seemingly would have been Hillary Clinton in 2016, which it was. So yeah, it was a weird setting to say that, you know, the complacency, despite Trump's best efforts, is setting in. And, you know, for Republicans going into November, the 2018 midterm elections, they're working against history, but it's really starting to show that, you know, I don't think there's going to be as big a turnout as there will be during the 2016 election. I mean, you're going to see a lot more people vote against Trump and the Republicans simply because of their performance in office over the last year and change.
So in terms of CPAC, would you say it's just like complacent because they've gotten lazy, or is it Trump related or Trump backlash related?
Well, if you think about it, when Obama was elected, you know, I think there was a sense of complacency that set in on the Democrats' part because,
I mean, there's a normal sort of routine there.
Yeah, but so would you peaks say and troughs. And like, you know, people who were not really engaged in politics before the 2016 election, suddenly like politics became, you know, everything that they did after Trump won, because nobody saw, very few people saw his win on the horizon. And, you know, that's it's going to be much of the same. I mean, it's a pendulum swing for.
But you wouldn't say that you saw like less Trump support overall, or
no? There was definitely a lot more people who, you know, initially they were on the fence, and now they're full on the Trump train. And but the pendulum is swinging back towards the center, and I can definitely tell with the lack of numbers at CPAC, we're probably going to get that sooner.
It does seem like a lot of Republicans really enjoy or really have the ultimate goal of being an opposition party.
When they can't be an opposition party,
they just quit.
You have the, you know, the professional losers in the sense that I mean that they prefer to lose elections because it keeps the fundraising up. It keeps them, for the ones who remain in power in Congress, you know.
It sucks, apparently, when they win.
It solidifies their power within Congress and basically opposing the president of the other party. In this case, if you want to look at under Obama, you know, Mitch McConnell became the most powerful Republican simply because he was the one working against Obama. And now that Trump is in office, you know, Mitch McConnell is now struggling to fight for power.
It seems like Chaffetz and Gowdy were both like, wait, what? We can't investigate Clinton anymore? We quit.
Yeah, I mean, for a lot of people, because Trump is in, you have two basically lines of thought. The first one is, we won. It is the best time for me to step out because, you know, there's no higher place to go. And then two, oh no, Trump is in office and we're going to get crushed in the next election. Best to bow out now before, you know, the tsunami of the blue wave comes through.
I have seen a lot of chatter from credible, you know, Texas familiar sources who suggest it really is possible Texas could at least, if not go blue, trend blue enough to be pretty frightening.
You mean for
Ted Cruz
and Beto O'Rourke?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Them and others too. Not just that, but even like state and local races.
Yeah, no, but I mean, the biggest upset would obviously be Beto O'Rourke over Ted Cruz because in February.
That could really happen.
Yeah.
And not just because of blue wave, but also because everyone secretly hates Cruz.
Well, that too. And also, you know, in Texas, Beto O'Rourke has been outpacing Ted Cruz in fundraising by a margin of 3-1, or ratio of 3-1, I should say. Like, it's actually getting to the point where Ted Cruz should start sweating a little bit, as great of a visual as that is, with respect to him winning re-election. I mean, he's going to have to get out there and start, you know, talking some ish again to try to get people to be inspired. I mean, he was at CPAC and he was not even the biggest. I mean, he was not the most, basically, he was not the star of the show like Trump was.
Has he ever been?
Well, yeah. In 2016, when Trump and Cruz were both hotly contested in the Republican primary, Cruz was the biggest star there and Trump got booed before he actually even showed up and he ended up canceling his appearance. But Cruz won the straw poll that year, and he was basically, that was the last time Cruz had really that type of stardom at CPAC.
Yeah. Cruz, if Texas really did go purple, you know, big if there. But if it did, he's not a guy that can win.
Yeah. I mean, this is the interesting thing that's happening in 2018. You know, in 2016, they ran on the message of Trump is horrible. Vote for me. But now that they've actually seen some of Trump's, you know, actions in office, they could actually win on the message of Trump is bad, vote for me. And it's working.
I don't know. Like, if it wasn't plain enough how terrible he was before he actually got in office, I don't think people will be convinced from seeing him now.
But here's the thing, though. People were so sure that Hillary was going to win. I mean, polls were showing that she was going to win. There were a lot of media outlets who were pretty convinced that she was going to win. So that drove down turnout, and people just didn't, you know, they either cast in, like, you know, a protest ballot, or they just didn't show up to the polls at all. And then Trump won the whole thing. Like, think about if in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, or even Florida, if any of those turned blue, or at least two or three of them, Hillary would have had that in the bag. But it just, you know, turn up. Like, everything, all the signs leading into the election killed her. In addition to, you know, her email server, in addition to James Comey, I mean, the fact that she was not able to win off of the Access Hollywood tape is stunning.
It's a stunning indictment on our current society, that's for sure.
True.
Speaking of the election, guess who's been once again talking all the time about it?
Trump.
Oh my God. When's he going to stop like retweeting those stupid maps?
I hope he doesn't stop just because it's so funny.
Like the latest one was actually a fake map too. It was like, you know, the typical like county versus city, red versus blue map that tries to show a bunch more red.
Right.
Yeah. But also it was a wrong map that like turned a bunch of counties red that weren't red. So not only was it pathetic because he's like bragging about a win a year and a half ago, it was also a false map.
Yeah. It's a great time to have a president on Twitter. Let's be real. I mean, like it's, we never got this under Obama. I mean, like we got like such classy and scripted tweets from him.
It's just way too dignified.
Yeah. And this is just like, I mean, I will be very depressed once he leaves office, not because of the state of our country, but because like it is a truly entertaining time to cover a presidency.
As a reporter, I can see that.
Some people might say, like, Suraj, how can you say that? Like, he's destroying the country. Like, yeah, I mean, like, as a citizen, I'm with you. But, like, as a journalist, like, this is like, the peak. This is a golden age right now of journalism covering this Trump White House.
I will say when Trump won, I've had some bitter thoughts about, like, how reporters seem to be all, like, now's my chance to be, like, the rebellious, like, upstand against authority.
I mean,
like,
there are a
journalistic
lot of them.
Figurehead hero. I'm like, okay, great. I'm glad you have your chance finally.
I mean, but, you don't have to go far to find reporters who have kind of found fame out of rebuking the president or his staff, like Jim Acosta of CNN, Brian Karam of who's a mostly freelance, but he's had bylines in Playboy and stuff like that. I mean, like, these people weren't nearly as big as they are now because they've been basically going against the president.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be the next Woodward Bernstein.
We'll see.
We need the next deep throat is what we need. Plenty of choices.
Oh, man. By the way, that's the worst code name ever.
It is. How do you even know how that happened? Like, my whole life I've always known, like, obviously, you know, it's a Watergate thing, but, like,
I don't know.
No one ever addresses like the why deep throat exactly?
It's such a, I mean, it's a phenomenally horrible code name.
I mean, I'm sure that sounded bad back then too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where
it's supposed to probably. I'm sure after we're done, I'm gonna go Google it and find out why once and for all it's called deep throat.
Oh my God.
Are you hiring? Every business needs great people, and there's a better way to find them. Something better than just posting your job online and just hoping that the right people happen to come along and see it. And that's ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter knows there's a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next person to hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applicants you receive so that you never have to miss a great match. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/45. That's ZipRecruiter.com/45. To choose your next hire today, go to ZipRecruiter.com/45 for ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We also got some sort of election-related news this week in the terms of a preview of the IG's report on McCabe. Now, did you see that?
The Inspector General on Andrew McCabe. I'm trying to recall the actual story because it is on the tip of my tongue, but it had something to do with investigating Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. So Trump, of course, is in the whole all right. It's all eager for this IG's report to come out. And theoretically, it's going to, like, you know, somehow imprison Hillary Clinton, overturn the New World Order and, you know, enshrine Trump's presidency forever or something like that. But it looks like, from what we've seen so far, the report is going to criticize McCabe for how he handled leaks about Hillary Clinton. So that, on one hand, yay, Trump is vindicated because he really wants the report to show McCabe was a bad guy. But on the other hand, no, it's not good for Trump. It totally destroys his entire narrative because it shows that what McCabe did wrong was harming Hillary's campaign, not his.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think I glossed over the story. And, you know, the one of the things as a reporter, just as a side note, is despite the fact that you're covering the news, you feel so isolated from the news because there's so many stories coming out. So, yeah, Andrew McCabe, I mean, at one point, I'm sure people from the opposition felt sympathy for McCabe with respect to his dealings with Trump, but I'm sure a lot of that is gone now.
I mean, it's kind of a weird tension because on the one hand, no one who actually cares about the country wants to see the president attacking our law enforcement in this way. On the other, it's not like the left has like an institutional trust and love for law enforcement in general.
For sure. I mean, if it was Obama attacking law enforcement,
oh my God,
the left would
I don't know about that. Not
they,
like this.
They'd throw their panties on stage. I mean,
I don't know about that. Not in this case. This is the way Trump's doing it is so horrific. I don't think
it's a different level. I think people thought Obama was very anti-law enforcement given his response to a lot of the shootings of young African-American men and women. This is a completely different institutional level where I think if Trump really hated the FBI, he would go after them for nonpartisan reasons. Like Martin Luther King Jr. Day was an interesting time for Trump not to criticize the FBI.
But. Yeah, it's like me. Like, Trump doesn't know enough about the FBI's actions to really have a deeper opinion on it. What he doesn't like is them investigating him.
Yeah.
And McCabe, of course. I mean, it does seem like the whole deep state narrative may be true if it's applied against Hillary Clinton, because it does seem like there was a lot of action taken in the FBI that ended up harming her. Although excluding the New York office, I don't think the FBI's actions were intended to hurt Hillary. I think Comey and McCabe and a lot of the FBI, like, their ultimate priority is often the FBI to the exclusion of America itself. Yeah. And I think the way they handled the Hillary investigation was designed primarily to help the FBI, not to hurt Hillary or help.
Right. Yeah. It was a CYA cover your ass move, in a sense, because I think they realized they'd
look better and they could come off like the real heroes if they attacked and showed how nonpartisan they were.
Yeah. Like Hillary. If you look at, how things went down between Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch on the airplane tarmac garnered a lot of criticism. Probably more, it was warranted in a sense because it, despite whatever they talked about, it looked pretty bad to the public eye to be during an investigation of Bill Clinton's wife.
We say that, but look at how they reacted now to seeing Trump regularly, like publicly and privately, ask for like favors. Yeah, you should care, but in this world, it seems so strange that people cared about it.
It's just very wild because, Trump handles it so differently when the shoe is on the other foot. And, when it's on his foot, he does a really bad job of handling it. But I think the public's reaction is we're not legitimate. I think we are trying to hold his feet to the fire, but we somehow give him a pass because there's another story that needs to be covered and we get distracted or we fall for another Trump tweet that comes out and we just lose our minds over it.
And plus, the only people who can really hold Trump's feet to the fire are in Congress, and they're not doing it. So
that and the DOJ. And the DOJ, Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein, as of recent, have seemed to be, rebelling a little bit.
Yeah. After Trump's tweet last week, about the, I can't believe the IG and not the DOJ is investigating all this stuff, rah, rah, disgraceful. And of course, finally, Mr. Keebler Elf over there makes his first public comment in response to Trump's attacks on the DOJ. When he was attacking the DOJ in general, of course, he said nothing. But once it come for him personally, he made a comment about it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the DOJ is that despite the fact that Trump's people are running it, there's still a lot of Bush and Obama holdovers who are, holding down pat. And I mean,
career officials, let's call them what they are.
Career officials at this point. And at this point, with respect to the DOJ, I don't think Jeff Sessions really holds any loyalty to those people. And therefore, he will not come out to defend them because he thinks they are part of the deep, quote unquote, deep state. And they're there to undermine his authority as well as President Trump's. But one thing that is interesting is that I feel like Jeff Sessions is almost daring Trump to fire him. By going, rebelling in this way, because, Jeff Sessions should absolutely uphold the laws of, and the Constitution, and not simply be there to serve the president because that's not his job, and he is, you know, in public office. He's there for the taxpayers, not for the president. So Trump is really miffed that he is not, you know, Jeff Sessions doesn't have his back like he thought he once did.
Where's my Roy Cohn? But despite the tension between Sessions and the DOJ, or the, you know, the fact that Sessions' loyalty may not lie in institutional interest of the DOJ, it seems he has made a decision that when it comes down to it, he's better off siding with them over Trump, because last week he made a normally uneventful trip with the, you know, number twos and threes of DOJ for dinner. Which would be totally, absolutely normal in any universe but the current one we inhabit, because that was probably intended to be and was seen as a sign of disloyalty by Sessions. And Trump was apparently really pissed by it.
Yeah.
Super duper pissed.
Yeah. And we can go back and forth all day on what Trump was actually thinking when he saw that. But I'm sure, yeah, it wasn't positive.
And it should be noted that last week actually was like a shit show, even by current standards. It was pretty awful. Like, Trump is melting down. Pretty universally, the agreement of those in the White House and those close to him is that he is like flailing right now. It's bad. It's ugly.
Yeah. But I will say this, and this is just because this is kind of a very private function, but the gridiron dinner in which Trump was at on Saturday night, he was making jokes about like Jared Kushner losing his security clearance, saying like, oh, we were late to the dinner because Jared couldn't get through security. Like, haha, very funny. Like, I'm sure he's like seething underneath, but like, he's at least trying to give off the impression that he views this all to be one big joke in some respect. And by joke,
sometimes
I mean, like,
trying to give that impression. And then yeah. He goes on Twitter and writes just in all caps, witch hunt.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing. It's like, I don't know what Trump tweets are really sincere. Like, because there are times when he's absolutely trolling us. And like, you can tell. But like, there are times when I'm on the fence with him and like when he's actually trolling us. And sometimes I think he is solely putting out tweets just to distract us from what's really going on.
I think in general, there's very little divide between the performance and the man.
That's probably true. But, you know, I'm sure that the departure of Hope Hicks didn't help.
No picks.
No picks.
Yeah, no, that's the other big event this week, is that Hope Hicks on Tuesday, she testified before the House. And the next day that she announced she was quitting.
Which is, you know, this is something that
totally
happened.
Unrelated.
It's unrelated. She hold on. I'm sorry. Unrelated to Jared Kushner, but I meant like she did the testimony. She testified to the House Intelligence Committee. The White House pushed back, saying that her quitting is not related to her testifying, which I do kind of believe because of, you know, reports are saying that she was actually, you know, mulling this for some time.
Okay, but so that was like Maggie Haberman from the New York Times. Her tweeting instantly after this happened was like, all my sources say that Hope's been thinking about this for months.
Her sources
like,
are pretty good, though. I trust Maggie.
Her source is Hope Hicks.
That's, I mean, one of her sources.
That's the person who's been leaking to her forever, it seems like.
Maybe. I mean, and I think, what's his name? Jonathan Swan of Axios. He also has very good
also
sources.
Also Hope too. Hicks. It's pretty well known. Like, that's like pretty openly sourced.
I think for both of them, they have more than just Hope.
They do. They do. But Hope has been a very reliable feeder for certain people in the, you know, D.C. White House press corps.
But then again, I mean, you have Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon. Both of them leaked a lot. And while it's not fully proven, it's all the signs point to them.
And then there's Nunberg. Everyone's like
Anthony Scaramucci, the best. The Mooch.
God. I like how for Nunberg, they're like, an anonymous source, who maybe Nunberg has told us, like, they don't even bother to hide anymore. It's ridiculous how, like, I mean, they're frustrated by it. Like, and there's been times when Stephen Miller has, like, wanted to, or not cared if he was anonymous or not. And then you have Sarah Sanders pushing back and making sure he remains anonymous or in background for, you know, certain briefings.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about what's going on in the White House, I know that most Americans don't care about the, like, reshuffling or the chaos in the White House. But it does matter in terms of policy and what Trump is trying to do, because if he has people, if he surrounds himself with people who don't share his vision, or they're either too extreme to his right, which, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would be like, that's too crazy because Trump is so extreme to the right. Actually, Trump is like a pseudo-Democrat for the most part, considering what we saw.
Okay, no. That's not going to be allowed. That's not true.
Considering what we saw in his DACA meeting, I mean, a lot of people would argue. And DACA and gun control, those are the two things that
he's not a pseudo-Democrat. He's just a blank slate on the inside with very little in the way of actual policy beliefs, but who has found Republicans to be receptive to his message.
Well, and this is just the thing is, like, maybe pseudo-Democrat is too strong of a word, but he's a man who doesn't really have any personal convictions.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's a fair statement.
Wherever the big wind blows, that's the direction Trump is in.
Yeah.
And I used to criticize Hillary for the same exact thing, but she happens to have, I guess, stronger convictions than Trump.
Low bar. But Hope Hicks, I mean, it may not have been directly because of the testimony she gave. Like, it might have been a one-to-one causation there. But the idea that she's been planning to leave, or, like, this is part of, like, a normal transition, is hilarious. And it's so weird that we're treating it as on its face value.
Yeah, I mean, it comes at a horrible time.
Did you see her statement about, like, why she quit? She told colleagues that she had accomplished what she felt she could with a job that made her one of the most powerful people in Washington, and that there would never be a perfect moment to leave.
Oh my God.
Yeah, because a 29-year-old with no experience in this field is leaving for new opportunities from the White House.
Oh, my God.
Like, of course it's Russia-related. Of course it has to do with the chaos there. Of course there's a scandal behind it.
I'm just interested to see who is going to pick her up on TV. I imagine CNN's going to try to grab her.
Or she has apparently she's been keeping a diary while in office. And,
I'm sure she's got some stories to tell. And she's either A, writing a book, or B, getting a contributor contract, or C, both.
Yeah, and apparently her attorney's fees are way out of control, unsurprising, because other articles came out last week to say that Trump's been basically compromising her, not in the external sense, but in the sense that's causing her to legal liability, because he keeps talking about the Russia investigation in front of her and increasing her problems, increasing her attorney's fees. Yeah, I mean, I have no sympathy for her, but she's in a hard spot.
Yeah, no, the thing is, and she's only 29, she's only a year younger than me, to be in her position.
and she's already decided that the White House is a stepping stone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where you go after White House besides, like, you know, making your own country and running it. That's,
She's going back to Connecticut, apparently.
Ooh, my neck of the woods. I don't know where she's from.
Hey, she's single now, I hear. You can go find her.
Oh, really? Well, my girlfriend would be thrilled to hear that. So Hope Hicks and Rob Porter are no more.
Yeah, they have broken up. And speaking of what you're saying earlier about the people and Trump's White House mattering, this is a good example of that, because Rob Porter, he was one of the people that was trying to hold the boat together when it comes to trade policy.
Yeah.
Because Trump's instincts are protectionist.
And what's amazing is how Don McGahn, Trump's lawyer in the White House's counsel, has kind of shielded Rob Porter from both Trump and Kelly's wrath, although more so Kelly, because I feel like Kelly is the only person who would really have – you would find it morally reprehensible what Rob Porter did.
Oh, bullshit.
He should. I mean, like
– I should.
And here's the thing is, I don't know if those questions have been fully fleshed out as to whether what John Kelly knew and when he knew it.
Because he's lying about it constantly.
Well, there's that. And there's also Don McGahn, who probably is more responsible for shielding Rob Porter. And I wrote a month or so ago when this whole thing broke out that, you know, both of them needed to resign if they knew, you know, if they knew what they knew at the time that they knew it, and they did nothing. And I don't
Which
know if
they
anyone's...
seemed to have, especially, I mean, Don McGahn had to have. There's no way he couldn't have.
Oh, no, Don McGahn for sure.
And it seems very, like, people have gone, not on the record, but people, talking reporters, have confirmed over and over again that yes, he knew. Yes, he knew for a long time. And he asked people to lie about it so he could maintain his cover story that all he knew about was emotional abuse.
Yeah, it's just a bad situation altogether, and I know we're rehashing an old story, but, like, it does matter in terms of what the people who are still in the White House, and that, you know, we shouldn't forget that those are the people that the president surrounds himself with.
And I have to imagine that one of the reasons that, you know, Kelly McGahn did go to bat for them and did not push him out is that they felt like perhaps he was a positive influence on Trump's policy directions, which to a limited extent he may have been, because he was the one, once he was out, Trump very quickly started having a bad week. Apparently he's on a diet too, which I'm sure is helping matters.
I'm sure that's really helping his mood.
he takes it out by announcing a trade war on metal and steel.
Yeah. So what's your take on it?
Oh my God. It's like you would think with a guy with no internal policy, like consistent philosophy, that just by pure chance, more often he would align in some ways with my views. But it's like he's actively choosing the worst fucking policy in every single occasion. I'm very adamantly pro free trade.
As am I.
Yeah, and it's horrific to see, like, one, this happen, and two, Republicans actually embracing it.
Well, actually, not as many Republicans are embracing it. I think they're
protesting it. They're very muted.
I mean, if you look at Ben Sasse, he's been probably the most outspoken with respect to this story, because this type of, and I should also say the editorial board at the Washington Examiner, who I work for, we've come out against it.
Supporting Nazis, okay, whatever, Trump. Trade war? Oh, no, sir, you go too far.
When it comes to bra shopping, it's all about finding the right fit for you. And there's only one lingerie brand that offers bras in sizes AA through G, as well as half cup sizes, and that's Third Love. Third Love uses thousands of real women's measurements and super smoothing memory foam to create bras that fit better and feel great. Did you know that most old school bras only carry 15 sizes? Well, Third Love has 60 sizes, including half cups. And if you've never heard of half cups, that's because no one but Third Love does them. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now, they're offering our listeners 15% off their first order. To find the bra you've been waiting for, all you have to do is answer a few quick questions from Third Love's Fit Finder quiz. It just takes 60 seconds, and you can do it all from the comfort of your home. So try a Third Love bra. It's so comfortable, you might forget you're wearing it. And if you don't agree, returns and exchanges are always easy and free. So this year, make the change that will change the way you think about bras. Go to thirdlove.com/45th to find your perfect fitting bra and to get 15% off your first order. That's thirdlove.com/45th. thirdlove.com/45th.
But yeah, I mean, this is the type of economic protectionism we don't need. How I do understand the flip side of the argument that there is a national security tie-in to these particular tariffs that he's trying to implement with respect to steel. So, yeah, absolutely. I've been talking about this quite a bit. So basically, the national security tie-in is by implementing these tariffs, basically the Trump administration is trying to punish China and put pressure on the Chinese government get them to stop basically exporting goods and financial support to the North Koreans, so that the North Koreans can finally come to the table for negotiations with respect to denuclearizing their arsenal and, you know, basically not being as isolated and possibly softening their harsh regime against their people. The 25 million or so North Koreans are currently suffering under Kim Jong-un's reign. And by going...
Okay, but before you even go there,
sure.
Where are you seeing this linkage between the steel tariff and China's North Korea policy?
The thing is, with respect to steel and aluminum,
they explicitly made that case?
Have they explicitly made that case? I don't think they've explicitly made that case, but the theory is that by implementing these type of tariffs, and, you know, the United States has tariffs on multiple things.
For that to work, it has to be like an actual connection between them. Like, China would have to know that's actually the case, what's happening here. I don't think there's any indication from the White House that that's what it's going to be about.
No, there's not. I mean, this is all at this point speculation that this is what they're trying to do, and kind of taking a broader approach that, you know, they're playing like three-dimensional chess instead of what they would assume to be checkers, in the sense that by going after trade and trying to punish China this way, and in the same sense, you know, burning bridges with Canada, Mexico, and the European Union and going to trade war with them, that he's achieving the broader picture of trying to get the North Koreans to the negotiating table. I don't think it'll work, but that's what they seem to be doing.
That's a very generous interpretation. I think this is just Trump doing what he always wanted to do, which is to somehow increase America's standing in the world by using America's supposed economic might to prove we're the big dog or something. Okay, let's be real. Trump actually does not know the difference between a budget deficit and a trade deficit. He actually literally thinks that when we have a trade deficit, it means we're losing money. Like, that's a debt we have. Mm-hmm. Kind of the level of policy skill we're dealing with here. And his, did you see his tweets about trade wars are good and easy to win?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think he really knows what anything. With trade policy, I mean, he's been talking about this for decades, and I don't think he's really, I think he's like basically looked at one article, tried to understand that that's what trade is, and then no one has tried to tell him otherwise.
I think they've tried to tell him. It's kind of like the deal with like the lottery, the Visa lottery.
He doesn't listen to anyone.
He's incapable of understanding what's actually going on. And this is how our like serious trade policy issues are now decided, is Trump is like mad at his diet and mad at like losing some of his people. So he responds by declaring a trade war because he always wanted to.
It also works against the interests of those who were benefiting from the GOP tax cuts. So a lot of people who are getting, some of that money back by not paying as much in taxes are now suddenly at risk of losing their jobs or possibly not being as competitive on the free market because, you know, when you have these tariffs going in, you know, companies are purchasing less steel and less aluminum to make their products and the cost goes up. It hurts consumers, and then you're going to have people who are going to lose their jobs. You know, when President George W. Bush did this back in the 2000s, he raised steel tariffs to 30%, and the industry lost 200,000 jobs. So it's a very weird industry for Trump to try to revive. Just like coal. I mean, like, we're in the 21st century. These are parts of energy and infrastructure, and especially infrastructure, given the fact that our nation's crumbling roads and bridges and we need steel. I mean, like, what is going to be the cost and how much taxpayer money is going to go into these projects considering that we're now implementing these new tariffs? There are a lot of questions up in the air, and I don't think anything's going to really be settled. But I will give Trump the benefit of the doubt that if he's really about bringing the North Koreans to the table, putting economic pressure on the Chinese is the one thing that might do it.
Yeah, if that was actually aimed at this, which I don't think it is. We've had like 20 infrastructure weeks so far. How is that not fixed infrastructure yet?
Each infrastructure week gets better than the previous one. Don't you know that?
It's remarkable how consistent that's been.
52 weeks in a year of infrastructure week.
The never-ending infrastructure
week. That's every week.
Well, the industry is, industry people have basically unified this is a bad idea. There's not any support that I've seen for people actually in business. But there's one person at least who wasn't hurt as bad as he might have been hurt by the steel tariffs.
I mean, the thing is, you know, I see the beer industry really.
Well, did you see the Carl Icahn?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, so Carl Icahn's already been in trouble because he was an advisor to the White House. He was advising on things he had direct financial interest in. A story came out about it, and he resigned very quickly and claimed, oh, wait, I never actually worked in the White House. He's been, you know, this figure on the periphery ever since. And he's another billionaire, a million, I don't even know. Probably billionaire or something. He owned a lot of stocks in a crane manufacturing company, like 31 million
shares. Oh, yes, and... You know, this is one of those things where I glossed the story but didn't have a chance to read it. So please, yes, continue.
Yeah, so on February 12th, just a few weeks ago, after not selling or buying the stock for at least 3 years, he suddenly sells off millions and millions of dollars worth of the stock. We don't know quite how much because he only had to report it because he had a greater than 5% share in the company. And once he sold off enough to go below the 5%, he no longer had to report it. But he sold off millions of dollars of this Manitowoc share. And they make, you know, so they use a lot of steel because they make cranes and I don't know. It has a lot of steel in it, I'm sure. I don't know the technical side of it. But it's pretty obvious that a steel tariff is going to harm this company pretty bad. So February 12th, that happens. He sells it off. February 16th, we get the report from Wilbur Ross in his little can of soup saying that they should have a 24% steel tariff. Yeah, this is a problem because then we had the steel tariff go into effect and Carl Icahn is sitting pretty with his sold off shares that didn't suffer the dramatic decline that happened after the tariff. This is basically absolutely insider trading. And they're going to go with the it's a coincidence argument, but good luck making that one.
Yeah, no, it's too close to the line. I mean, it's a legit question to go after Carl Icahn and with respect to his steel stock. I mean, it's not, you would have to be absolutely oblivious and removed from anyone within Trump's circle in order to not raise questions of insider trading. I mean, this is policy that doesn't just get fleshed out in a week and then they roll it out. Like, it takes months and months of deliberation. And if it's a week beforehand, like, that definitely raised some red flags. Totally. Yeah, with you.
And that's their excuse. They're saying that, Trump's been talking about this for a long time, so it's no surprise. And of course, anyone could have known this was going to happen eventually. Yeah, sure. Everyone knew that Trump was thinking about it, but no one was sure enough about it to start dumping off their steel stocks a week before it actually happened, other than Carl Icahn.
Yeah.
One other, swamp story from last week has to do with a sort of, I had not heard of him before now, but a Republican donor and fundraiser named Elliott Broidy. And he has managed to get into not one, but two different scandals this week due to some leaked emails. Have you seen this at all?
No. This is a completely new story.
Well, the first Broidy scandal involves Malaysia. We'll start there. So back during the last year of the Obama administration, back in like summer 2016, there was a action filed by the DOJ, civil forfeiture, and it was seeking to recover $1 billion in assets that were allegedly came from misappropriation by a Malaysian company called 1MDB. It's a state-owned company and established by the prime minister. Now, $1 billion's a pretty big number, so Malaysia wasn't too thrilled with this. So Malaysia reached out and found itself kind of a lobbyist. It's the Republican fundraiser, Broidy, who gets a deal that says if he can convince the DOJ to drop the investigation into 1MDB, he gets $50 million. And if he does it within 180 days, he gets $75 million.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And I'm sure the scandal is just going to grow. What we know right now is that someone who it's unclear who. There's two different stories out there from like New York Times and I think Wall Street Journal. And they received copies of these emails from an unknown leaker. So it's not clear who obtained them, but they're interesting to be kind of opposed to what Broidy's doing with regard to Qatari issues. But as far as Malaysia goes, the emails are pretty striking. Probably the most significant one is from this year, January 5th, 2018. And the subject is Rick Gates' talking points.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's all we know right now. There's nothing more on like what this came from, like or why Rick Gates' name is here. The article is like, could be a reference to Rick Gates, the man who recently pled guilty. Yeah, no, it's definitely a reference to Rick Gates. So he is apparently involved in this mess too.
Yeah, and it's dated January 5th, 2018. So that's after he was at least indicted with Paul Manafort.
Yeah, and so the talking points are, there's two different versions of them, but the first draft says, we are working with the DOJ to counter the previous administration's case against 1MDB in Malaysia. I have put a strategy in place to connect parties with the DOJ and NSC to find a resolution to this issue. Now, the other fascinating part, and lots of fascinating stuff going on here, but for me, what was most striking is the second point. And between the two different drafts of these talking points, what they say is that I'm in the process of scheduling a meeting with the Assistant Attorney General, Rachel Brand, who has oversight for the Malaysia case. She is a Trump appointee and can be helpful. Rachel Brand, you may recall, was number three of the DOJ until very recently when she announced her sudden and striking departure.
That's right. I do remember that.
That seems really shady to me. I mean, there was like a lot of speculation on why she was quitting at this time and going to Walmart. But from these emails, she was considered a persuadable voice at DOJ who would go along with what these lobbyists that apparently that Rick Gates is involved in wanted for Malaysia. And for Broidy, who was going to get $57 million based on the dismissal of the case.
Wow. That's a lot to take in right there.
I think we're at the very tip of the iceberg on the story. We know Mueller's looking into it. I mean, these emails are not conclusive proof, but they're damn close to it. And they point to something much larger going on. And that's kind of, it goes back to the Mueller investigation as well. Russia is a huge deal. I am not a fan of stories that downplay the significance of it or try and say, oh, it's not that big a deal. It's a huge deal. And it's like an existential crisis for America. But it's not just Russia. It is a massive problem for a bunch of countries that are not necessarily in line with our interest, who are now able to manipulate the U.S. government to a degree they couldn't ever before. And this is an example of that. Malaysia is using this lobbyist with connections to the Trump administration to get an investigation against it dropped.
It's not unheard of for foreign countries to hire lobbying lobbyists to basically lobby on their behalf. I mean, that's pretty normal. I think we should actually make that clear to our audience. But yeah, if you're trying to get that, this is a tie-in directly to the Trump campaign concerning Rick Gates as a close associate of Paul Manafort.
And Broidy, who has had multiple meetings with Trump.
Right. So, I mean, it doesn't fully, you know, like people talk about pay to play, which, you know, Trump obviously engages in. There's, you know, been multiple instances of him giving leniency to people who meet with him or try to do favors. I mean, that's, we're learning more and more now. It seems as if, though, that with respect to this level of, I want to say, corruption, really?
That's the word you're looking for.
It's not, it's just a reminder that politics never changes and that, you know.
This is a new level, though. Again, yeah. this kind of stuff, the swamp was always a swamp. There was always this kind of, like, I mean, that's why we have FARA, and hopefully it'll get enforced in the future. But this kind of direct connection and direct payoff for this kind of dismissal of investigations, that's not a level of corruption that America is typically engaged in.
Yeah, or been exposed to, at least on you know, this level. I mean, that's the thing is, like, we, you know, this type of corruption may have been happening for, you know, quite some time. It's just the only, it's just like with police shootings. We're only, you know, they've been happening for as long as, you know, we can remember. But we're finally getting exposed to all of this level of corruption. Therefore, it seems like it's happening every day.
Well, yeah. And I think there's definitely been a huge quantitative and qualitative leap in what's going on. But that's not the only Broidy issue we have this week, because the hacked emails also show another country that's using him to get into the White House, and that's UAE. And this is a New York Times article. And according to them, and then they're trying to explain where they got these hacked documents from. This is the Broidy's response to it. We have reason to believe the hack was sponsored and carried out by registered and unregistered agents of Qatar seeking to punish Mr. Broidy for his strong opposition to state-sponsored terrorism. Yeah, so that is not what's going on here. Broidy is opposed to Qatar. Qatari interests have reason to oppose what he's doing. But this cover story that's about state-sponsored terrorism goes back to sort of like Kushner and Trump's own Qatari issues. It has to do with Broidy's ties to Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, which I'm sure I pronounced wrong, aka MBZ.
MBZ.
He has been, he's basically in charge now of Abu Dhabi, and he's very rich.
So this hack of the email that you just read of Elliot.
That's his statement in response to it, yeah.
Oh, the statement was hacked.
No, that was, so in response to the hacks that were released, that's a statement that Broidy gave to explain why he was being hacked.
I see. Okay. All right. So there's a lot of moving parts here. And, you know, it's interesting. That, I mean, like, the U.S. government is definitely opposed to Qatar and with respect to their level of state-sponsored terrorism and how they're funding groups in the Middle East that are causing a lot of this, you know, this destabilization. One of the things, though, that the Emirates and the Qataris, the Emiratis and the Qataris, they really hate each other right now. And because of that feud, Qatar has been completely isolated from the rest of the Middle East and the GCC. And so I'm sure they're trying to curry favor within the White House in order to kind of change that relationship with the Saudis.
They absolutely are. And right now it does appear that the Emiratis have the advantage. So the Emiratis are trying to push their advantage here and use their connections, people like Broidy, to get private meetings with Trump. But the Qatar story has a much, much deeper problem here, potentially. And this finally brings us back to our boy Kushner. The Kush has a big problem. The Kush has 666 problems.
666 problems, and Ivanka ain't one.
Ivanka 8-1. No, well, Ivanka's won because she's also got her own problems. And next week, we should go into Ivanka's issues over in Vancouver and Panama with her money laundering towers there. but we'll make this week a Kushner week. So what do you know about 666 Fifth Avenue?
What do I know about it?
Yeah.
Not a whole lot.
Yeah, it's a very big problem for the Kushner family. 666 is the building they bought back in 2008.
Mark of the devil.
Yeah, they're trying to get the address changed too and not having luck yet.
Oh my God.
They paid $1.8 billion for this office building. It's kind of outdated, not in a very fashionable area, and probably very definitely wasn't worth $1.8 billion at the time they bought it. And they also bought it just before the economy crashed. So, and they only spent like $50 million of their own money on this. It was that $1.8 billion was almost entirely financed with debt. And after the crash, the rents it was bringing in were no longer nearly enough to pay off their, service the debt. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really big albatross around their neck for a while. Now to deal with this, the Kushner companies and Jared, they kind of pieced off like the retail area, sold it all off, and then they ended up selling off half their interest in the office section of the building to Vornado. Just so they could, stay afloat.
Right.
But through all of that, through selling off all the retail and half the office building, they were only able to pay off about $600 million of the debt. They still have $1.2 billion in outstanding debt that they haven't touched yet, even after getting rid of everything else they've gotten rid of. They did bring Vornado in, so Vornado's now a half partner in it, and they have half the debt to them. So in terms of the Kushner companies, I think their exposure is like $600
million. Wow. So
that's a lot of money.
I mean, $600 million, obviously, that's a big chunk of change, but the fact that they still owe $1.2 billion.
Well, that's combined now with Vornado, because Vornado has a half interest in it.
That's it.
So this debt also has a very, very fast approaching deadline, February 2019.
Less than a year.
Yeah. They have to come up collectively with $1.2 billion, or they're in deep doo-doo.
So what is the recourse there? They file for bankruptcy?
Who knows, but it would be pretty epic for the Kushner companies because they are not able to support this building, nor their other enterprises right now.
Will they have President Trump come in and, shift things around?
Well, I think they're more of a take action themselves kind of family. Mm-hmm. So this has been an ongoing problem. So, before the election, Kushner and his family were trying to find an investor that could help them out. And one of the major lines they were following up on was a Qatari billionaire named Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani, HBJ. And he was going to agree to invest $500 million in this building, so long as Kushner proved he could secure additional financing from other sources.
And has he been able to?
Well, China was going to step up and do the job with Enbang. Yeah, they were going to, produce somewhere with that funding, which combined would have been enough, theoretically, to save 666. But Anbang backed out, so the Qataris backed out. Well, first, HBJ backed out and his $500 million promise. Things got pretty dire. Now, remember, this also potentially goes back to Gorkov, the Russian president of the VTB, a bank that Kushner met with in December, one of the back-channel communications he had, which theoretically may have also been an attempt to seek loans or some kind of debt relief for 666. But in April 2017, so after the election, they're all in office, Kushner's dad, also a felon, met with the financial minister of Qatar. They were trying to make a last-minute deal to get some, state sovereign wealth fund money coming in to save everything. They also developed a very extremely ambitious plan to basically, watch the HGTV term, take the building down to the studs and rebuild it, or literally demolish it and rebuild it with a whole new design. This would cost like a gajillion billions of dollars. A few bajillion. Yeah. At least like $7 billion, I think, is what they're looking at, which is not going to happen on the Kushner's fund. And they need some really big backers here to get involved to save it. It fell apart. End of April, they had two meetings. The Qataris like, no, this is a stupid plan. Never going to work. We're out. Guess what happens the next month?
Tell me.
Another Middle East crisis. This time Qatar against basically everyone else around it. And there's a blockade against it. And guess whose side the Trump administration takes?
The Qataris.
Not the Qataris.
Not the Qataris.
This is when
I knew that.
My
brain's shutting down.
But it's also a hard question to answer, too, because there's not really a Trump administration in the normal sense of the word. The White House was obviously siding against Qatar, as you can tell from Trump's tweets about it. But Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, executive branch cabinet member in theory, was trying to bring an end to the standoff and to support, take less of a side in the matter. So there were multiple opinions underneath the executive branch label, but it's clear where Trump was at.
So with respect to this deal falling apart, Trump going against the Qataris seemingly trying to save his son-in-law with this, or at least the son-in-law's family, with respect to this giant-ass building. There's a lot of... I'm trying to figure out, how's President Trump not kicked Jared Kushner out of the White House already? Given what he has brought in and all the baggage he's brought in with him, that level of debt and basically no security clearance at this point, I'm struggling to find a reason why I would keep somebody like that on.
Because that's the whole point of being in power, in Trump's view, is to use your power to make these kind of deals. Kushner's doing what he would do and is probably doing himself.
Yeah, but you also are subject to more, you know, if you have outsiders coming in to fund the, or at least pay off this debt that the Kushners have built up, I mean, if you have the Qataris coming in now, all of a sudden the Trump administration owes something to the Qataris. I mean, that's...
Or in this case, the Qataris don't come through with the loan and the Trump administration punishes them by siding against them in a blockade and a new crisis begins in the Middle East. Yeah. Which is what happened here. And
no, I know. It's just, I don't understand.
It's horrific.
Yeah. I don't understand how this is all happening. It's amazing.
But wait, it gets worse because guess who Kushner's new BFF is?
Not Ivanka.
I don't think she ever was. But yeah, okay. No.
Come on. When you say you marry your best friend, does that not count for something?
I don't think that was what the Kushner-Ivanka power couple was supposed to accomplish.
Damn.
But back up a bit. In April, this deal falls apart with the Qataris. May 7th, Jared personally calls the CEO of Lockheed Martin and asks her to cut a sweet-ass deal for the Saudis for a missile defense system.
Big fan of ass deals.
Yeah. He wanted some sweet, sweet discounts on missile defenses for the Saudis' benefit. So it seems like as soon as like the Qataris didn't come through, he starts courting the Saudis for their money. Now, then October, he makes his like third trip of the year to Saudi Arabia, where he meets with another young princeling. And, quote, the two princes are said to have stayed up until nearly 4 a.m. several nights, swapping stories and planning strategy.
So...
A few days later, what happens? The Great Saudi Purge.
Oh, yeah. I remember the purge.
Which mysteriously happened right after Trump started tweeting about Saudi Arabia and New York.
Then... What's going on in Saudi Arabia is very interesting because, and one, Kushner being tasked with trying to find a Middle East peace deal at this point is pretty laughable.
Poor Kushner has to like solve the opioid crisis, bring peace to the Middle East,
the guy's got
save his $1.2 billion building.
And he lost his security clearance. I still don't get why he has him on still. I mean, I know there's a different level of nepotism with respect to this White House, but like, come on. Like... Kushner can't do anything right now.
I'm sure whatever deal was going on, Trump's going to get some cut of it.
It's just too much to bear right now.
Yeah, I think we'll find out more about this because Mueller is looking at the Saudi Arabia issues and the other countries there. And this part has not been reported on. This is me speculating. But it's a matter of time before we find out that Saudi Arabia was lining up to do a bailout on 666.
I mean, that's not hard to imagine. Or speculate that sounds like a pretty logical conclusion that given what we know about Kushner's dealings with the Saudis and also the Qataris, that the Saudis would be the ones who would bail them out.
Yeah. So American foreign policy is now based on like what our royal family's financial interests are.
Yeah. And they just got too much money over there and they're figuring out ways to make more money, which by, you know, reducing their reliance on oil. I mean, the Saudis, they're just trying to make themselves a multidimensional economy. So, yeah, Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince over there, he's got some stuff up his sleeve and may be good for the U.S., may not be great, but,
It's going to be good for 666 and the Kushners.
It might be. We'll see.
Their new bestie.
Best BFFs.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the corruption is so unimaginably large and open these days. it really does feel like we're not in America anymore. This is not the stuff that happens in America. This is the stuff that happens like over in Turkey or other countries that like pretend to be democracies but aren't really and just have open corruption all over the place.
By the way, when you heard, so Trump at the Gridiron Dinner joked about Chinese President Xi Jinping about abolishing term limits.
That was not there. That was not Gridiron. Those were comments made to Republican donors.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was before. Yeah. It was before the Gridiron Dinner. My apologies. But do you think that was? You think that was a joke about him wanting to try getting rid of term limits here in the United States, or do you think there's some truth to it?
I didn't even hear a joke in his voice. People laughed when he said it in the audio. But like, what's the joke there? Like, they're going to claim obviously he was joking about wanting to, you know, get rid of term limits here. But like, what? How is that even a joke? It's only a joke if Trump actually wants to do it and you're alluding to the truth. It's not a joke in any other context.
I mean, if he wanted to do it, there would be swarms and masses of people who would stop him. I don't think he'd actually go. I don't think this is a battle he can win.
We've already pressed the line so far on so many issues. I don't think we can say now where the line actually stops.
And not to mention, I mean, well.
Thank God he's old, though.
Yeah, he's, I mean, 71. He's a young 71. But I was going to say, you know, with respect to the gun meeting he had with lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and him talking about, you know, getting rid of due process and taking the guns first and then discussing due process later, like, that was probably more authoritarian than him talking about abandoning term limits.
It's all kind of the same vein, though.
Yeah.
He doesn't have any respect for the rule of law. He has no respect for a democracy. He has no innate appreciation for the Constitution. And these are all symptoms of the same thing.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I mean, he does have a very wishy-washy relationship with the Constitution, says he respects it. I don't really think he does.
I like how when Sam Nunberg was saying how he tried to explain the Constitution to Trump, he only got to the Fourth Amendment before he had to give up because Trump was lost patience. Oh, he's like, the Third Amendment, what's this bullshit? I'm done.
Oh, but the Third Amendment is great. There's like this wonderful Onion article about Third Amendment rights activists. It's so funny. And for those who don't know what the Third Amendment is, it's basically gives people the right to not house and quarter American soldiers or soldiers on your property. It's really funny. People never talk
Trump
about
it. Trump will find a way to violate it. It's like on his bucket list.
Yeah.
So that's this week on the exciting life and times of Hope Hicks, Rob Porter, and the Kushner, the Ivanka family. We'll be back next week to see how the meltdown continues and hopefully discuss more about Ivanka's own business deals and how her own corruption may be coming to play in Mueller's investigation. Thanks for listening. And until next time, this was the 45th Podcast.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th Podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345. And you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.